Good morning. Morning across most of the world listening to me right now. Although where I am, it's, I don't know, a little after 2 in the afternoon. But the room is darkened down for Coast. And by the way, Andrew in Tremont, Illinois said, "Hey, Art, don't forget Heinlein's razor." I thought it was Occam's, but he says Heinlein's razor. "Never attribute to malice that which can be adequately explained by stupidity. Pity. Perhaps the only villain is poor funding and organization. Not much consolation, though." Yeah, I know. And, you know, speculation is all you can do when you don't know anything else. And when they block themselves off and wall themselves off so it's impossible to talk to them, you're left with nothing but speculation. So I hope that those of you who are listening to me right now will take a moment, just a moment, to go up to the website, click on the, you know, the whole thing. And by the way, you can read the evidence that I supplied there, and then read the whole thing down at the bottom, or not at the bottom, but actually pretty far toward the top, I guess. There's a little link you can click on, and you can actually write the President of the United States. And I would be so appreciative if, in my behalf, you would do so. Not that I necessarily think it's going to go anywhere, but you never know. As I mentioned, I've been an Obama supporter since way back before it became fashionable, so perhaps somebody will take notice. Gee, this does seem like a lot of messages. Maybe we should look into it. But I'm not placing bets on that. Coming up in a moment, Robert Kuntz. Now, after Robert Kuntz earned his, listen to this, PhD degree in experimental nuclear physics at the University of Maryland, he became a staff scientist at Lawrence Berkeley Labs. He's taught analog and digital electronics at the National Security Agency. That's the no such agency place. Taught physics at the University of Maryland and at the University of South Dakota. His lifetime National Security Agency clearance is top secret with cryptographic endorsement and code word access. Whew. In 2002, Dr. Kuntz took several fairly clear photographs of a disc-shaped object that was flying over central Pennsylvania. This led him to begin research into anti-gravity. There's nothing like seeing something like that to fire you up and change your life. So he started looking into anti-gravity. All this culminates in an experimental test of the Biefield-Brown anti-gravity effect in 2003. For the last 6 years, Dr. Kuntz has been investigating methods of producing energy following the work of Nikola Tesla and Dr. Thomas Henry Moray. According to Dr. Kuntz, an American inventor by the name of Stan Meyer demonstrated to a patent examining board, I guess you have to be patient when you're getting patents, but he was, and he explained to them that Mr. Meyer's invention could produce hydrogen quickly enough that a car could be made to essentially run on water. And since I'm in the Philippines, and we'll talk about this, I'm sure, there's a fellow here in the Philippines who is running a car on water. Such a car was then produced by Stan Meyer, who is now deceased. Finally, Dr. Kuntz says he believes that if we do not have a true energy revolution in this country and the world, and I think most of you agree with that by now, then because of massive indebtedness, and we've got plenty of that, massive deficit spending, plenty of that, the U.S., and the world is likely to enter an economic dark age that may greatly exceed that of the Great Depression. We're all worried about that. But he says, if we act in time, then a new golden age could arise for America and the world. In a moment, Dr. Kuntz. Well, all right, here we go. Robert Kuntz, welcome to Coast AM, your first appearance.
Thank you, Art. It's very nice to talk with you. This is a great honor for me. I've been a fan of yours for 20 years. I've been with you through Mel's Hole, the interview with Bob Lazar, The Sounds of Hell.
Well, you really have been
and
there.
And many other things. Oh, yeah. I work nights, and when I work nights, I listen to you. Because, listen, Art, you don't have to be right all the time. You don't have to be right 90% of the time. You only have to be right once in the things that you address, such as UFOs.
Well, you're a relative, I think, of Dean's, aren't you?
Dean, yeah, that's my cousin. Yeah,
your cousin. Mm-hmm. I had the pleasure of interviewing Dean some time ago.
He's quite a fellow.
He's quite a fellow, is right. And apparently so are you. And I, usually somebody who has a PhD degree in experimental nuclear physics, has been at Lawrence Berkeley labs and all the rest of it, would be, really, really hesitant to report one of those things.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Probably. Well, you can do better than trouble. I mean, how hesitant were you? You saw the thing, you got a photograph even. And so how long did you think about it, Robert, before you reported?
7 years.
Ooh, that's a long time.
So I didn't go public with it right away. Now, this is a pretty good picture, in my opinion. You know, some people report a blob in the sky, and they call it a UFO. But in my opinion, this is not a blob in the sky. This is not a UFO. This is a picture of a flying saucer. Now,
I would agree with that. I've seen the photographs. There's a few questions I have about them. For example, the object appears to be, and you document it, trailing smoke.
Well,
I don't know.
That's an
somehow
interesting question.
You know, unless the object is wounded, you know, and on fire or something like that, you wouldn't expect smoke from a UFO traversing the sky.
I agree with you, Art. Now, that raises the question of what's going on here. Now, first and secondarily, this object was traveling very slowly. I estimate the speed to be 10 or 15 miles per hour. Mm-hmm. I took 20 pictures, and with my little pen cam camera with a bitmap image processing system, a CCD type device, a relatively inexpensive thing.
Still, and although you're one in a million, most people who see UFOs curse themselves later for all the cameras sitting at home.
Yeah, I understand that. But also, it was bright daylight. This was 11:30 in the afternoon on August 8th of 2002, and bright, bright day, and I stopped my car. I saw this unusual I thought it was a contrail, but it wasn't a contrail, but it was so unusual, I stopped my car. Now, at that time, you were talking a lot about chemtrails. And
yes.
I thought, well, maybe this is something to do with that. Now, I don't necessarily know what chemtrails are or whether they're regular trails or not. But anyhow, I took these pictures, and then I moved my car to get closer to the object. I drove about 6 miles, 7 miles. Now, the object had to be moving slowly if I'm driving my car 6 or 7 miles to catch up with it. And I took, I don't know, 3 or 4 more pictures, took them home, blew them up on the computer, and I found that it was a disc-shaped object with a dome. It's not just a disc-shaped object. It's got a dome. There's two orientations of it. It's traveling slowly, and it appears to be traveling, trailing smoke. So now my conclusion then was, not my conclusion. My thoughts were, what is going on? And what is holding that thing up in the air? I mean, you know, there wasn't it wasn't traveling fast enough for there to be some sort of lift, and the aerodynamic design of the thing wouldn't seem to be like an airplane. So what is holding it up? And I came to the conclusion it was some sort of anti-gravitic system.
Well, Bob, my late wife and I, if you've been a listener a long time, I think you know we had a sighting of a triangular object.
I know that.
And I estimated it, 30 or 40 miles an hour. It was directly above us, and I said the exact same thing. Look, this was not aerodynamic flight. Simple as that. The air wasn't moving fast enough to hold this thing up. It was massive. And so same thing in your case. What did you conclude, Bob? Is this what, in other words, you thought very hard about this for a long time before reporting it, 7 years.
Yeah.
What did you see?
Okay. My conclusion was, my analysis was that either it's extraterrestrial or it's terrestrial. Now, either way, there's some sort of anti-gravitic thing going on, in my opinion. I don't see any other way. So that led me to do anti-gravitic analysis and experiments and research. But now, let me go back to the trailing smoke. I think the thing appeared to be wobbling. I took two different pictures of it at different angles. It was, that is to say, its spin axis had two different orientations. So it looks like it was wobbling a little bit. It was traveling very slowly, moving maybe 15 miles an hour, and it was trailing smoke. It did not appear to be an exhaust, but rather appeared to be trailing smoke. So it looked to be some sort of craft in distress. Now, whether or not that was extraterrestrial, I can't say for certain, But I don't know of any flying saucers in our inventory that are flying over central Pennsylvania at 11:30 a.m. and in the middle, you know, the day, and such a bright day, and all these circumstances.
So well, the one thing I do know, Bob, is that it changes your life. You're never going to be the same person again after you've seen something like that.
Oh, yeah. Now, those black triangles, that's another subject I'd like to talk with you about sometime. But what's going on with those? I mean, I've got a neighbor over here, a very trustworthy lady who I know very, very well, and she saw this black triangle, a very large solid angle, that is to say the angular width of the object in the sky was very large. It was not a distant object. It was traveling very slowly, maybe 10, 15, 40, 30, 20 miles an hour. And she got a good look at it, and she got a look at another time of a triangle, a black triangle.
Now, Bob, there have been thousands of those reports, and the type that you've given us, fortunately, with the photographic evidence to go with it. But and I came to the same conclusions, Bob. It was either extraterrestrial, a strong possibility, I thought, or terrestrial with a propulsion system that involves the repulsion of gravity. Now, there are so many implications to this with regard to, I mean, we're in deep doo-doo in this world right now for energy.
We are, you know, with our debt, $12 trillion, and we've got $1.8 trillion estimated deficit this year, and, you know, 7 million people unemployed, 10% unemployment rate. We've got serious problems, and you're exactly right, Art. This could be the answer. Surprisingly, UFOs can lead us to energy.
Yeah, but here's the problem, Bob. Yeah. If we possess this kind of technology, if we possess some sort of anti-gravity drive, the implication is that we would solve our energy problems. And then you've got to wonder, what in the world our own government would be doing, ignoring a solution at a moment of crisis in America and the world. Why would they continue to hide this if it was terrestrial?
Well, I don't necessarily believe they are hiding it, Art. Maybe they are hiding some of it. I believe that the Russians, formerly the Soviets, had some of this technology with their scalar electromagnetic weapons that Dr. Tom Bearden has talked about. And I've seen evidence that those weapons have been used with a reach to reach America.
But Bob, they are hiding it. I mean, they have not applied the technology in any way to the private sector, given it to any company who's said, well, look, okay, we can build this little thing. It'll run your house. It'll run your city, whatever. We're at a moment of crisis in the world. We're polluting the hell out of it, and so they are hiding it. I'm sorry, they're hiding it.
The Russians might be. I don't know about American scientists. Now, you know, the way things get clogged up in the government, there could be some thick-headed character at the top of the food chain that's saying no to all this. And I, you know, it isn't as if President Obama or formerly President Bush is responsible, because this never reaches their ears, in my opinion. A lot of this is held in held close to the vest by some clique or group of individuals at the CIA or at the national security level somewhere, and they keep a lid on it, at least the UFOs. Now, my opinion. We've been visited. I can't, you know, let me be frank with you. I don't think that was one of our craft. I don't think we have flying saucers flying over Pennsylvania like that in the middle of the day. I mean, you know, maybe we do, but I don't think so. And so I'm pretty sure. And that, not only that, there's lots of other evidence. I've researched this enough to conclude pretty much 100% we're being visited by extraterrestrials that have anti-gravitic technology and other forms of technology that are extremely advanced. I don't know how far, maybe a million years. It could be a billion years more advanced than we are. And, you know, the universe is supposed to be 14 billion years old approximately. Our solar system is only maybe 5 billion years old. So what is that? Even before our solar system was formed, there could have been 9 billion years of development.
Well, Bob, there's a lot of anecdotal evidence, and I guess you can argue some serious photographic evidence and some serious evidence, but there's no smoking gun that I'm aware of, Bob. Now, you've done a lot of research. Maybe you've stumbled into one, but there's nothing that you can say incontrovertibly, here it is, smoking gun. We're being visited. They're here. They have this technology, and if you've got that smoking gun, lay it out.
Okay, let me just put the evidence forward. Now, part of it is represents testimony. You know, when you have a nuclear, you know those, you were in the Air Force, I believe.
I was, yes.
Yes, and you know those guys down there in the nuclear silos, the ones with the keys that sit in those padded chairs on the spring.
Right, right.
Those guys don't mess around, all right? When they tell you, if a person with that kind of background tells me that a flying saucer or a UFO shut down his nuclear silo, I believe mm-hmm. him. Rather
yes,
than
I'm well aware of the stories. I guess you're referring to the silos that were in fact shut down by UFOs that hovered over them some many years ago now.
Exactly, and those one or more of those people, kind of men, testified with Dr. Stephen Greer at the National Press Club.
Yes.
So we have the testimony, and then there's also Philip J. Corso, Colonel Corso's testimony.
Now, I've heard Colonel Corso many times.
I know you have, Art. I've listened to it many times, over and over again. I dissect these things. I deconstruct everything I say. Why would this guy lie? Why I don't just say, oh, yeah. I don't necessarily believe anything. I really think about it. And Colonel Corso was not a man who's going to be making up these kind of stories. Very few of these guys would do that.
But it's still, Bob, anecdotal. Maybe you can make the argument that collectively all of this eyewitness testimony adds up to a smoking gun, but not for the really hard-hearted.
Okay. Now, there is the work of Dr. Roger Lear. He has removed a presumptive implants from individuals, including one U.S. American scientist. And they analyzed these objects, and they found they had non-terrestrial isotope ratios in the device, if you will.
That
if I can use
true.
That term, device.
I know.
Non-terrestrial isotope ratios. Now, how does a person, get non-terrestrial isotopic materials in his body, his arm, his foot, his ear? How does that happen? Now, secondarily to that, Dr. Lear also indicates that these devices emit electromagnetic radiation that would be akin to great radio waves in the region of 90, in the FM spectrum, maybe around 93 megahertz. I don't know exactly the frequency. Okay, thirdly, these devices, when examined by scanning electron microscopes, show microstructure. That is to say, microscopic programming type things like integrated circuits, but maybe more sophisticated.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those are three things right there. There's non-terrestrial isotope ratios. There is the microstructure, and there's emission of electromagnetic radiation from these devices. And then there's additional testimony relating to other physical phenomena that occurs in association with those implants. So that's evidence. So that's right there is evidence. So it isn't as if there is no evidence.
No. Now, collectively, there is a very great deal of evidence, Bob. But again, for those who are not going to be convinced until they lay their own hand on something extraterrestrial, until they're told by, oh, I don't know, President Obama or, you know, somebody at that level that it's real, it is so, it's on CNN, that's when people will believe. And until then, they're going to say, oh, come on.
Well, Art, you know, I think you're right. There are lots of people that are just going to say it's all nonsense. And, they're free to do that. This is a free country. But my opinion is that the evidence, if one carefully examines the evidence. Now, I tell you something. Some of these skeptics that they roll out.
Bob, I've got to hold you there.
Yeah,
we're at a break point. Bob Kuntz is my guest. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM. It is good afternoon from the other side of the world, everybody. The Southeast Asian capital city of the Philippines, Manila. I'm Art Bell. It's great to be here. Robert Kuntz is my guest, and he's got some pretty impressive credentials for somebody saying what he's saying. PhD degree in experimental nuclear physics at the University of Maryland, staff scientist at Lawrence Berkeley Labs, and on and he worked with the NSA and on and on and on. He saw something he cannot explain, as so many millions of us have. It changes your life, and what you're going to hear is just not the sort of thing you would hear from somebody with these kinds of credentials normally. So listen closely. We'll be right back. Think that we may be back. We had a momentary glitch, and I think we're back with Bob Kuntz. Bob, are you there?
Yes, sir. I'm here.
Well, I was not saying, yet.
Yeah. Yes.
I don't know if you can hear me.
I can hear
not,
you, Art.
But we had sort of a little. We had a little glitch is what we had, and so far it continues to glitch because
Hello.
I'm not hearing anything coming back. Oh, bear in mind that we're working from one side of the world to the other, and so
Hello,
I guess
Art.
For some reason I have no audio coming back, so I have serious doubts that we're actually on the air. But one never knows, and one told me a long time ago that if you have a microphone in front of you, never say anything that you wouldn't say otherwise. So I will refrain from doing that, and I will go ahead and disconnect what apparently is not working. We'll go ahead and drop this and hope they reconnect. Okay. We are now back on the air, and hopefully we've got Robert Kuntz back with us. Robert? Okay, they're currently calling back our guest. And again, for those of you who are tuning in late, I would very, very, very much appreciate your going to coastcoastam.com, our website, and taking a look at this incredible story that I've put up there for you. And I would deeply appreciate it from the bottom of my heart if you would take the time, a moment or two, and dash off a note to the president based on what you read. Again, not that I think it'll necessarily register and do any good, but it's just a way of, I don't know, complaining to a high place. The USCIS has themselves walled off so well that, that it's simply not possible to get hold of them. And, all right, Robert, I guess you're back.
Yes, sir, I'm here.
I have a feeling they may have had a power outage or something of that sort in California because you disappeared, as did the connection between this side of the world and California.
Well, I'm still here. I didn't actually disappear, but
sometimes you have to wonder. You get into some of these sensitive subjects, Robert, and you have to wonder. I wonder frequently. Anyway,
Yeah. You've
done. As a result of what you saw and the fact that you've been, you know, then motivated to get into research about all this, you and I are going to have to disagree. I've got to take the, even though I could not be more of a believer, I guess I understand. You know, I worked with Dr. Greer and others, just about everybody in ufology for all these years. And so I'm pretty much of a believer, but I understand those who are not. And I understand what it's going to take for them to become believers. However, we're fortunate that you have the kind of credentials you do, fortunate that you saw what you saw, and that led you into research into anti-gravity. In fact, more than that, it led you into experiments with anti-gravity. And I would be very, very interested in what those experiments, what you did and what they proved.
Okay. Well, let me first give the listeners my website so they can look at the pictures later and then
Sure. Follow
all this. Okay, that's
sure.
drkuntz.com, drkuntz.com. Okay,
all right.
With respect to the anti-gravity, we don't necessarily have to believe in extraterrestrial spacecraft in order to discuss anti-gravity.
Right.
Somehow, this object I saw was suspended in the air, more or less. Now, let's assume that there are objects that can be suspended in that way, even, no matter where they come from. Okay, now, what is going on with the physics about that? What is holding it up? And the answer would be that if there's no helicopter-type action going on or something like that, then it's got to be, and if it's not nuclear, physics has something called the standard model of four forces, the electromagnetic interaction, the gravitational interaction, and two nuclear interactions, the strong and the weak. Now, if we can rule out the nuclear interactions, the strong and the weak nuclear interactions, that leaves you with electromagnetic interaction and a gravitational interaction. Okay, now, the electromagnetic interaction is the interaction that allows us to build transmitters and receivers and integrated circuits and all those things. And the gravitational interaction is what causes something to have a downward force due to the mass of the Earth, for instance. Okay, so how then do we engineer some sort of electrogravitic interaction? There's got to be some sort of connection between electricity and gravity, electromagnetic interaction and gravity.
So I'm certainly willing to accept the possibility, sure.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's see now. Einstein tried to unify all the forces when during the latter days of his life. He was unsuccessful, but he had the idea that they were all unified in some way. So possibly, let's at least accept the possibility there's an electrogravitic interaction, an interaction between the electromagnetic field and the gravitational field. And I do believe that's what's going on here. And so what I did was I started, after I took the pictures and blew it up, I didn't try to decide if it was an extraterrestrial spacecraft or not. I just believed it was some sort of anti-gravitic interaction and with that craft. And I started to do research in anti-gravity. So here's a long story made short. I came up with something called, I researched this and found something called the Bayfield-Brown effect. Now, Bayfield was Dr. Bayfield, Paul Alfred Bayfield was his name. And then there's another fellow named Townsend Brown. That's Dr. Townsend Brown. These are both both PhD physicists. Dr. Bayfield was a colleague, a fellow student with Einstein. Dr. Brown was an excellent physicist, did very good work. And so let me tell you this in language that I believe you understand as a ham radio operator. Okay, you know what a capacitor is, of course. And
of course.
A parallel plate capacitor can be made by taking, let's say, two sheets of aluminum. 8x10, let's say, and putting between them a dielectric, perhaps Mylar is a good dielectric because it has a high breakdown voltage. If you put a high voltage, maybe somewhere between 20,000 and 100,000 volts.
Now, this is a voltage without a great deal of current. In other words, we're talking almost about electrostatic
exactly.
charge.
Uh-huh. No current, very little current flowing through, just a leakage current flowing
right.
In the capacitor. So you
right.
put this high voltage on there, and according to the Bayfield-Brown effect, the capacitor tends to translate or lose mass in the direction of the positive plate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, what I did was I did a classical Bayfield-Brown experiment. I set up a very delicate balance beam made of non-conducting material, wood and styrofoam or styrofoam-like materials, a balance beam, you know?
Like, sure.
Okay. So then I put capacitors on both large area capacitors, 8x10 capacitors, on both plates, on both the sides of the balance beam. Now, then I left one of the capacitors uncharged, and I charged the other one up to about 20,000 volts. And I had a camera set up so I could get away from the system and away from the high voltage, and I could observe how much the balance beam moved. And what I found is that the balance beam arm moved at its outer, that the greatest distance was about 2 or 3 centimeters,
mm-hmm.
something like that.
Okay.
And it lost about 10 milligrams of effective mass. So I confirmed in my experiment the Bayfield-Brown effect. Now, there's probably been many people that have done this. I don't know if it's always been publicized, but now
okay, let me interrupt, Bob. There have been many, who have subjected materials to the effect that you're discussing, and they have observed, I can't recall what the percentage is of, you know, they actually weigh the items, and so they can measure the amount of weight reduction as this is being applied, and they do measure very small amounts of weight reduction, perhaps enough to move something around, perhaps enough even to cause something to hover in midair. I think they've taken mice and other small animals and had them hovering in midair.
Well, that's conventional physics there. That's the levitation of an object with the conventional physics. That's magnetic field physics there. This is something different. Now, let me just say something about this. There are people who think they're doing the Bayfield-Brown experiment with these so-called lifters. Mm-hmm. They'll make an object that's very light, made of aluminum foil in a certain manner, and they'll charge it up to high voltage with a wire, and the object will hover and float around. Mm-hmm. But that is not the classical Bayfield-Brown effect. The classical Bayfield-Brown effect is where it's something other than ion wind.
Okay.
But many people get this confused. Let me just say again, it's not ion
wind. I guess I'm one of them. I guess I'm one of them. I thought you were referring to essentially the same experiment. I guess not.
No. I'm talking about – now, Dr. Brown – did his experiments in vacuum, so it couldn't have been – some of his experiments were done in vacuum, so it could not have been ion wind, because ion wind is caused by the flow of ions around the metallic materials under high voltage due to the presence of oxygen and hydrogen and air, basically. Okay? So now if you do that in – again, if you do that in vacuum, you're not going to get – the ion wind that some people have. Now, I'm not saying that the ion wind isn't a contributing factor to the lift of these objects. It probably is. But what I'm saying is there's another more fundamental effect called the Bayfield-Brown effect that has to do with anti-gravity. Now, this can be done fairly easily by physicists all over the world. It is not a big project. It may be a couple weeks at most or a few weeks.
All right. Break it down for those of us who need the simple version. When you have done this successfully, what exactly have you proven, and where do you go from that point? In other words, you've made something a little lighter. You've changed its apparent mass temporarily. Where can this possibly lead?
Well, it looks like there's okay, if you hypothesize that there's an electrogravitic interaction, then this experiment indicates that is indeed a possible electrogravitic interaction, i.e. anti-gravity.
Mm-hmm.
So my experiment and the experiments of Drs. Bayfield and Brown indicates that Einstein is right about his unified field theory, at least concerning the electromagnetic interaction, in that there is a possible anti-gravitic effect. So I would say that anti-gravity, I'm convinced that anti-gravity is possible.
All right, let me try this avenue with you, Bob. If you had unlimited funds, which almost no scientist has, but assuming for a moment you had unlimited funds and you could proceed from the experiment you did, attempting to get to the point where you could lift a craft off the ground and defy gravity and slowly rise and then finally leave the Earth's atmosphere, how would you proceed?
Well, let me just say this. You know about John Hutchison.
I do.
Okay. Now, John Hutchison, this is more sophisticated than the Bayfield-Brown effect, much more sophisticated. Now, John is a master instrument maker. He is not a conventionally trained scientist. He doesn't have advanced degrees, and he doesn't have knowledge in mathematics and conventional physics, but he's an intuitionist, if I can use that term. He is a brilliant scientist in his own right, and he is a brilliant instrument maker on the scale of Tesla. I mean, he builds very beautiful instruments. So he built these Tesla coils. I think they're somewhere between 1 megavolt and 5 megavolts. And he put those Tesla coils in opposition in the sense that the electric, an ordinary Tesla coil will spark. Well, these Tesla coils, as I understand it, were set up so they didn't spark. And what they did was produce canceling. This is critical. If people would understand this, it'd be very important. Canceling electromagnetic fields from two Tesla coils and possibly some other fields. He produced effects which caused, among other things, a 70-pound cannonball to float around, levitate.
It's pretty serious.
It is pretty serious. And I'll tell you, this is gravely important for the security of this country. This is not a trivial matter. This is not inconsequential. You know, some of these people who dismiss John Hutchinson just by saying he's a fake, that's nonsense. I know the fellow. The man has given me proprietary information that I have used to verify some of his experiments, most notably in his energy cells. I've replicated it. Now, let me say also, he has done other things. In front of engineer George Hathaway, which was videotaped, he took a piece of aluminum, I believe it was, 3 by 3 inches by 6 inches or something like that, and turned that aluminum into powder in the presence of these canceling electromagnetic fields. Powder.
The last I heard of him, he was having grave difficulties with the Canadian government, local and national, I guess, of some sort. And they were, trying to get him to clear out all of his equipment and stop what he's doing. Am I right?
That's correct. Now, what happened was John was causing things like some lady's jewelry just turned to mush in a neighbor's apartment, I understand it. And doors, he caused doors to open and close and all kinds of things. And so people, I can understand what their reaction, but, you know, it's kind of dumb with the police to come in and put this guy in handcuffs. Just they should say, what in the world's going on here? We need to investigate this. If the Canadian people would wake up to the resource that they have in John Hutchison, he is a great scientist, and he has done wonderful things. And if they would wake up to what he's doing and try to replicate and understand what he's doing, they could have tremendous economic benefits.
Well, Robert, I think the Chinese say that the nail sticking up is the one that gets pounded down. And you know, he's been pounded down. There's no question about it.
Yeah.
Well, so you think his research, in fact, his demonstrated experiments, and I presume all of this is available on videotape?
Yes, I have it on my website.
Oh, you do?
I have the links to the these videos on his website.
All right. Mm-hmm. All right. The next obvious question is, aside from yourself, Bob, when you go to other legitimate degreed physicists, scientists, others who might be able to verify his work and or your work, what do you meet up with?
Well, I said that George Hathaway is I don't know if he's a PhD engineer, but he's an engineer. He's a member of the IEEE, which I used to be a member of the IEEE, too. That's the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers. And so he is an engineer. He went to Canada. He sat there and watched this metal change from solid state into powder. Now, and this is cool, too. It doesn't heat up. It just breaks down. Now, there's one person. Now, let's see. What else?
This is going to take, to become anywhere near mainstream, it's going to take an awful lot. It's going to take a number of degreed scientists to look into it, replicate the experiments. You know, that is science, replicating things. Mm-hmm. That's what it's going to take. And so we're coming up on a break.
Well, that might be true, but also if Art Bell were to go to somebody that had a car, let's say that man in the Philippines, if you have enough knowledge of electronics as a ham radio operator. And
listen, we're at a break. Yeah. We'll pick up on exactly this point when we get back. This is Coast to Coast AM.